Greetings, namaste. So, this time we take up chapter 9 in Essays on the Gita, Sankhya, Yoga, and Vedanta. It came into print in the Arya on 15th April 1917. The first two articles in the issue were The Life Divine, The Progress to Knowledge, and in the Synthesis of Yoga, The Soul and Nature. Purusha and Prakriti. So, the chapter we covered last time was Sankhya and Yoga, and now he's going to bring it into context of the oneness that Vedanta strives to achieve in its philosophy as the bedrock of its spiritual experience. Sri Aurobindo and the Gita insist on a larger system which unifies all polarities and makes one of all the multitudinous appearances in the universe. There is only one reality. So we begin. The whole object of the first six chapters of the Gita is to synthesize in a large frame of Vedantic truth the two methods ordinarily supposed to be diverse and even opposite of the Sankhyas and the Yogins. The Sankhya is taken as the starting point and the basis, but it is from the beginning and with a progressively increasing emphasis, permeated with the ideas and methods of yoga and remolded in its spirit. The practical difference, as it seems to have presented itself to the religious minds of that day, lay first in this, that Sankhya proceeded by knowledge and through the yoga of the intelligence, while yoga proceeded by works and the transformation of the active consciousness. And secondly, a corollary of this first distinction, that Sankhya led to entire passivity and the renunciation of works, sannyasa, while yoga held to be quite sufficient the inner renunciation of desire, the purification of the subjective principle which leads to action and the turning of works Godwards towards the divine existence and towards liberation. Yet both had the same aim, the transcendence of birth and of this terrestrial existence, and the union of the human soul with the highest. This at least is the difference as it is presented to us by the Gita. If you're looking for the textual citation, that would be chapter 3, shloka 3. So that's a summary presentation of where we were. The difficulty which Arjuna feels in understanding any possible synthesis of these oppositions is an indication of the hard line that was driven in between these two systems and the normal ideas of the time. The teacher sets out by reconciling works and the yoga of the intelligence. The latter, he says, is far superior to mere works. It is by the yoga of the buddhi, by knowledge raising man out of the ordinary human mind and its desires into the purity and equality of the Brahmic condition, free from all desire, that works can be made acceptable. So that's chapter 2, shloka 49, and later in the chapter, shlokas 71 and 72. Yet are works a means of salvation, but works thus purified by knowledge. Filled with the notions of the then prevailing culture, misled by the emphasis which the teacher lays upon the ideas proper to Vedantic Sankhya, conquest of the senses, withdrawal of the mind into the self, ascent into the Brahmic condition, extinction of our lower personality in the nirvana of impersonality, for the ideas proper to yoga are as yet subordinated and largely held back, Arjuna is perplexed and asks, Shlokas 1 and 2 in chapter 3, if thou holdest the intelligence to be greater than works, why then dost thou appoint me to a terrible work? Thou seemest to bewilder my intelligence with a confused and mingled speech. Tell me then, decisively, that one thing by which I may attain to my soul's weal. In answer, Krishna affirms that the Sankhya goes by knowledge and renunciation, the yoga by works. But the real renunciation is impossible without yoga, without works done as a sacrifice. Again, 3:3. Done with equality, samatha, samatva, and without desire of the fruit, nishkama, with the perception that it is nature which does the actions and not the soul. It is not Purusha that does this, but Prakriti. But immediately afterwards, he declares that the sacrifice of knowledge is the highest. All work finds its consummation in knowledge. By the fire of knowledge, all works are burnt up. Therefore, by yoga, works are renounced and their bondage overcome for the man who is in possession of his self. Again, Arjuna is perplexed. Here are desireless works, the principle of yoga, and renunciation of works, the principle of Sankhya, put together side by side as if part of one method, yet there is no evident reconciliation between them. For the kind of reconciliation which the teacher has already given, and we can look to chapter 4, shloka 18 later, in outward inaction, to see action still persisting, and in apparent action to see a real inaction, since the soul has renounced its illusion of the worker and given up works into the hands of the master of sacrifice, is for the practical mind of Arjuna too slight, too subtle, and expressed almost in riddling words. He has not caught their sense, or at least not penetrated into their spirit and reality. Therefore he asks again, thou declarest to me the renunciation of works, O Krishna, and again thou declarest to me yoga. Which one of these is the better way? That tell me with a clear decisiveness. That's chapter 5, shloka 1. So we see this coming chapter after chapter. Arjuna still isn't getting this subtle distinction. How can I do action and yet remain actionless within? How can I see the opposite to be also true? So, Krishna answers, and here we're going to go to chapter 5. The answer is shlokas 2 through 4. The answer is important, for it puts the whole distinction very clearly and indicates, though it does not develop entirely, the line of reconciliation. Quote, renunciation and yoga of works both bring about the soul's salvation. But of the two, the yoga of works is distinguished above the renunciation of works. He should be known as always a sannyasin, even when he is doing action, who neither dislikes nor desires. For, free from the dualities, he is released easily and happily from the bondage. Children speak of Sankhya and Yoga apart from each other, not the wise. If a man applies himself integrally to one, he gets the fruit of both, because in their integrality, each contains the other. The status which is attained by the Sankhya, to that the men of the Yoga also arrive. Who sees Sankhya and Yoga as one, he sees. But renunciation is difficult to attain without Yoga. The sage who has Yoga attains soon to the Brahman. His self becomes the self of all existences, of all things that have become, and even though he does works, he is not involved in them. Again, this is a continuation of the next few verses, 5 through 7 in chapter 5. So yes, you can come to know what is the pure self and gain liberation through Sankhya, through the enumeration and distinction of the soul from the principles and becomings of Prakriti. But if you do yoga, that is to say, you learn how to do desireless works done as an offering, and still you have this intense identity with the Supreme, with the true self within, that is a greater yoga and is distinguished as being higher. It's better, it's more fulfilling. It's more in tune with how the divine itself is and does. Continues. He knows that the actions are not his, but nature's, Prakriti's. And by that very knowledge, he is free. He has renounced works, does no actions, though actions are done through him. He becomes the self, the Brahman, Brahma-bhuta. He sees all existences as becomings, bhutani, sarva-bhutani, of that self-existent being, Swayambhu, his own, only one of them, all their actions as only the development of cosmic nature, working through their individual nature, and his own actions also as a part of the same cosmic activity. So there are quite a few citations here to support that, if you're taking note. So again, we're in chapter 5, and chapter 5 also gives us shloka 24 here. But we can go back to chapter 2, shloka 30, and onward to chapter 6, shloka 29. Then on to chapter 9, shlokas 6 and 7. And of course, the culmination, chapter 18, shloka 61. This idea of sarva-bhutani, you see, is one of the redolent fragrances in the Gita. It comes to us again and again, wafting into our nostrils, because the idea of achieving oneness in the manifestation is an essential integrative point in the Bhagavad Gita and distinguishes it from all traditions of renunciation. What has to be renounced is the egoistic claim to the work, the thought, the illusion that one does the work, because really, the divine does. You become the channel. It is done through you, not by you. So he continues, this is not the whole teaching of the Gita. For as yet there is only the idea of the immutable self or Purusha, the Akshara Brahman, and of nature, Prakriti, as that which is responsible for the cosmos, and not yet the idea clearly expressed of the Ishvara, the Purushottama. As yet, only the synthesis of works and knowledge, and not yet, in spite of certain hints, the introduction of the supreme element of devotion, which becomes so important afterwards. As yet, only the one inactive Purusha and the lower Prakriti, and not yet the distinction of the triple Purusha and the double Prakriti. Because that third poise of the Purusha, Purushottama, the ultimate person, is the poise of the higher nature, Para Prakriti. This will come much later in the Gita. What we see then, being shown to us here, Sri Aurobindo is focusing on the first six chapters of the Gita, is a gradual revelation to Arjuna of the many-sidedness of what is possible to do in yoga. First you realize, then you include, then you greaten the realization, include still more, and wind up at the grandest synthesis at the end of the teaching. The first, if I didn't read this sentence, let me read it. It is true, the Ishvara is spoken of, but his relation to the self and nature is not yet made definite. The first six chapters only carry the synthesis so far as it can be carried without the clear expression and decisive entrance of these all-important truths, which, when they come in, must necessarily enlarge and modify, though without abolishing these first reconciliations. Twofold, says Krishna, is the self-application of the soul by which it enters into the Brahmic condition. That of the Sankhyas by the yoga of knowledge, that of the yogins by the yoga of works. Again, this is Shloka 3 in Chapter 3. Jnana yogena Sankhyanam, karma yogena yoginam. This identification of Sankhya with Jnana Yoga and of Yoga with the way of works is interesting, for it shows that quite a different order of ideas prevailed at that time from those we now possess as the result of the great Vedantic development of Indian thought, subsequent evidently to the composition of the Gita, by which the other Vedic philosophies fell into desuetude as practical methods of liberation. Desuetude means state of disuse. To justify the language of the Gita, we must suppose that at that time it was the Sankhya method which was very commonly adopted by those who followed the path of knowledge. This is a footnote. The systems of the Puranas and Tantras are full of the ideas of the Sankhya, though subordinated to the Vedantic idea and mingled with many others. This is true. As we've said earlier, Sankhya, once it enters into the thought stream of Indian philosophy, dominates from there. Sankhya terminology is still present in all of Indian thinking today. Any coverage of Indian philosophy has to deal with the terminology of Sankhya. Subsequently, with the spread of Buddhism, the Sankhya method of knowledge must have been much overshadowed by the Buddhistic. Well, we can rather gather that, because here the Sankhya that we meet in the Gita is not the Sankhya that we see evolved into the actual statements philosophically in the Karikas, Sankhya Karika. That is a system that is several hundred years after Buddhism has begun to dominate India, and is, like Buddhism, largely atheistic. The Sankhya statements that we see here in the Gita are 1,000 years earlier and might be at best contemporaneous with the emergence of Buddhism, but Buddhism does not dominate India yet in the time of the Gita's composition. So the philosophy here is not so set. When we get to the Karikas, maybe 1,000 years later, after the Gita, we have an ordinated philosophy, which is then built upon, refined, etc., etc., and then a gradual movement back to a theism, which would reintroduce Sankhya in some interesting thought streams. And of course, then we have Ramanuja's reinterpretation of the Gita, as he comes to comment and reverse the tendency of Shankara, who is wishing to read the Gita in a very different way than the Gita's active dimension seemed to indicate it should be read. So Buddhism here is, of course, non-theistic and anti-monistic. So let's read this. Buddhism, like the Sankhya, non-theistic and anti-monistic, laid stress on the impermanence of the results of the cosmic energy, which it presented not as prakriti, but as karma, because the Buddhists admitted neither the Vedantic Brahman nor the inactive soul of the Sankhyas, and it made the recognition of this impermanence by the discriminating mind its means of liberation. This is an interesting parallel, because Buddhism looks at the elements of nature, which are in constant movement. That constant movement means that no thing is ever permanent. So if impermanence is not simply the nature of physical existence, but also of psychological existence, of personality, then our identification with our ego as a permanent self must be false. So, if it must, in a sense, dissolve, as all things eventually dissolve, and be returned to the constitutive elements from which it sprung, then what is it that is watching? If Buddhism is striving for liberation and wants to attain an exalted state, exalted because beyond the grip of the senses and nature, then what is that? Buddhism says, of that we cannot speak. It does not obtain. It does no one good to try to speak about that, simply try to get that experience. Well, the Sankhya says the same thing, except it says that state of freedom is the Purusha who witnesses the Prakriti. Buddhism will not ascribe full being or real being to a Purusha because it can't lay its hands on it. It is not measurable. It occupies no space. It lasts for no period of time. Whatever Purusha might be, it does not obtain. It does not do anyone any good to try to describe it. But the two experiences of liberation, nirvana in Buddhism and the exaltation into moksha through samadhi in the Sankhya system, leads to the same divorce from nature. So which came first, Sankhya or Buddhism? We'll leave that puzzle for another evening. When the reaction against Buddhism arrived, it took up not the old Sankhya notion, but the Vedantic form popularized by Shankara, who replaced the Buddhistic impermanence by the cognate Vedantic idea of illusion, Maya, and the Buddhistic idea of non-being, indefinable nirvana, a negative absolute, by the opposite and yet cognate Vedantic idea of the indefinable being, Brahman, an ineffably positive absolute in which all feature and action and energy cease, because in that they never really existed and are mere illusions of the mind. So if Buddhism drives us towards nirvana, a blowing out of the sense of self, and an immersion through that experience into a fathomless shunya, a void, here we have Shankara stating just the opposite, but in a similarly world-renouncing way, saying the world doesn't exist. There is an immutable, pure being, an absolute Brahman. And it is an illusion to think that there is multiplicity and a self looking at that multiplicity. So they're similar. Advaita, in a sense, goes one farther, but on the side of pure being. Buddhism influenced the argumentation that Shankara brought to it. It is the method of Shankara based upon these concepts of his philosophy. It is the renunciation of life as an illusion of which we ordinarily think when we speak now of the yoga of knowledge, jnana yoga. But in the time of the Gita, Maya was evidently not yet quite the master word of the Vedantic philosophy, nor had it, at least with any decisive clearness, the connotation which Shankara brought out of it with such a luminous force and distinctness. For in the Gita, there is little talk of Maya and much of Prakriti. And even the former word is used as little more than an equivalent of the latter, but only in its inferior status. It is the lower Prakriti of the three gunas, Trigunya Mayi Maya. Prakriti, not elusive Maya, is in the teaching of the Gita the effective cause of cosmic existence. It's the utilitarian process by which the cosmos comes into being. We know that the real cause is the will of the divine. Ishvara insists by his fiat all comes into being from his being and are constituted in his being. So this idea is probably 1,000 years in development after the Gita's exposition of Sankhya. What the Gita proposes is what we now call proto-Sankhya, which was much earlier than this thing that Shankara was arguing against. So let's talk about Maya, as the word is used in the Gita. If you want these citations, you would go to chapter 2, shloka 45, chapter 7, there are a lot here, 13, 14, 15, and 25. In chapter 9, shlokas 4 and 10. And of course, in chapter 18, again, shloka 61. Am I wearing you out with citations? I hope that these things are somewhat interesting and useful to you. So I think we're going to put a bookmark there. We're going to divide this chapter up into three. And close with a reading from Savitri tonight. This is in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 11, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Mind. I think we're starting on page 262, if I can find my place. Our spirits break free from their environment. The future brings its face of miracle near. Its Godhead looks at us with present eyes. Acts deemed impossible grow natural. We feel the hero's immortality. The courage and the strength death cannot touch awaken limbs that are mortal, hearts that fail. We move by the rapid impulse of a will that scorns the tardy trudge of mortal time. These promptings come not from an alien sphere. Our selves are citizens of that mother state. Adventurers, we have colonized matter's night. But now our rights are barred, our passports void. We live self-exiled from our heavenlier home, an errant ray from the immortal mind, accepted the earth's blindness and became our human thought, servant of ignorance. An exile, laborer on this unsure globe, captured and driven in life's nescient grasp, hampered by obscure cell and treacherous nerve, it dreams of happier states and nobler powers, the natural privilege of unfallen gods, recalling still its old lost sovereignty. Amidst earth's mist and fog and mud and stone, it still remembers its exalted sphere and the high city of its splendid birth. A memory steals in from lost heavens of truth. A wide release comes near, a glory calls, a might looks out, an estranged felicity. In glamorous passages of half-veiled light, wandering, a brilliant shadow of itself, this quick, uncertain leader of blind gods, this tender of small lamps, this minister serf, hired by a mind and body for earth use, forgets its work mid crude realities. It recovers its renounced imperial right. It wears once more a purple robe of thought and knows itself the ideal's seer and king, communicant and prophet of the unborn, heir to delight and immortality. All things are real, that here are only dreams. In our unknown depths sleeps their reserve of truth. On our unreached heights, they reign and come to us in thought and muse, trailing their robes of light. But our dwarf will and cold pragmatic sense admit not the celestial visitants. Awaiting us on the ideal's peaks, or guarded in our secret self unseen, yet flashed sometimes across the awakened soul, hide from our lives their greatness, beauty, power. Our present feels sometimes their regal touch. Our future strives towards their luminous thrones. Out of spiritual secrecy they gaze, immortal footfalls in mind's corridors sound. Our souls can climb into the shining plains. The breaths from which they came can be our home. His privilege regained of shadowless sight, the thinker entered the immortal's air, and drank again his pure and mighty source. Immutable, in rhythmic calm and joy, he saw, sovereignly free in limitless light, the unfallen plains, the thought-created worlds, where knowledge is the leader of the act, and matter is of thinking substance made, feeling a heaven bird poised on dreaming wings, answers truth's call as to a parent's voice, form luminous leaps from the all-shaping beam, and will is a conscious chariot of the gods, and life a splendor stream of musing force carries the voices of the mystic suns. A happiness it brings of whispered truth. There runs in its flow, honeying the bosom of space, a laughter from the immortal heart of bliss, and the unfathomed joy of timelessness, the sound of wisdom's murmur in the unknown, and the breath of an unseen infinity. In gleaming clarities of amethyst air, the chainless and omnipotent spirit of mind brooded on the blue lotus of the idea. A gold supernal sun of timeless truth poured down the mystery of the eternal ray through a silence quivering with the word of light on an endless ocean of discovery. Far off he saw the joining hemispheres. On meditation's mounting edge of trance, great stairs of thought climbed up to unborn heights, where time's last ridges touch eternity's skies, and nature speaks to the spirit's absolute. Namaste. Jai Ma.